Father, we ask that you would grant us understanding, that you would grant us light, that you would grant us your help as we would consider matters that are, in some respects, complex, and in some respects challenging to our minds. We ask that you would grant that as we think through these things, light might be given to us. We cry out again that you would send forth your light and your truth and let them lead us. We ask this in Jesus' name. All right, now section 2 begins with an introduction which deals with Augustine, Aquinas, and Calvin, and basically deals with the whole matter of Augustine and the contrasting assessments of Augustine. And I'm just going to run through that section briefly. The first section, A, under the introduction, deals with the fact that Augustine has sometimes been thought of and viewed as the forerunner of Descartes because of his what's been called his philosophy of inwardness. And then B, and sometimes he's been thought of as the forerunner of Calvin because of his emphasis on the sovereignty of grace. And those are, according to Van Til, at least two very contrasting views of Augustine. And then under B, the contradictory currents in Augustine's thought, I make the simple point that the reason for these contrasting assessments of Augustine is that there were indeed, there were in fact, contradictory currents running in the great Augustine's thoughts and in his writings, and I give some proof for that. And then I come to see the conflicting interpretations of Augustine's apologetics, which are summarized in his great phrase, I believe, in order to understand, that just as there are conflicting assessments and interpretations of Augustine in terms of his innermost, his fundamental thought, so when you come to his apologetics, there are very great differences of opinion with regard to what he really taught. And I make the point again, the reason for that is that there were real contradictions within Augustine's thought itself, both in terms of the development of his thought and in terms of even its final edition, if I can put it that way. Well, you need to read pages 22 to 30 because I'm not going to lecture on them. All right? Of course, it will be subject to quizzing next time. I want to come to the first of the two contrasting figures that I want to deal with in the Augustinian Church, and the first is, of course, a man whose work has been almost the, what's the analogy I want to use? It's been apical in its character, and everyone who wrote after Thomas Aquinas has had to interact with him and deal with the great system of thought in his Summa Theologica, which he developed. And so Thomas Aquinas commands our attention, and then in contrast to Thomas Aquinas, John Calvin, but we won't get to Calvin today. So by way of introduction to Thomas Aquinas, medieval theology came to its peak in the work of the one known to Roman Catholics as St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas lived during the High Middle Ages in the years 1225 to 1274. In his writings, medieval theology received a systematic, logical, and thorough exposition. It strikes me always when I think of Aquinas that and Calvin that we have exhibited in our very city the lasting impact of those two men in the Catholic College, Aquinas, and the Reformed College, Calvin. Although probably the neither of them true to all the principles of the men they're named after. At any rate, in his writings, as I said, medieval theology received a systematic, logical, and thorough exposition. Now, one, I want to deal with this context. Medieval theology exhibits a struggle between the spirit and principles of Neoplatonism and those of Christianity. Van Til says, throughout the period of the Middle Ages, the spirit of Plotinus, he was the perfecter of the system known as Neoplatonism, and the spirit of Augustine are struggling with one another for supremacy. Van Til believes that the deepest of thought and the most fundamental principle of Augustine's thought is the sovereignty of grace. And he views those two ideas as struggling for supremacy throughout the Middle Ages. in the Roman Catholic theology. The gospel of the grace of God through Christ may seem at times to be lost, but the self-attesting Christ appears in the end to be victorious. The early church fathers sought to present the Christ of the Scriptures to the men of culture of their day. In doing so, they all too frequently succumbed to the temptation of submitting the gospel of Christ to the standard of truth devised by the Greeks. So, too, many of the theologians of the Middle Ages succumbed to the temptation to compromise with the principle of apostasy so strikingly and climactically expressed in the philosophy of Plotinus. A few pages later, Van Til clarifies the precise nature of the compromise he has in mind. If it's permissible to speak in general terms of medieval theology, then this may be said to be its mark, namely, that committed as it is to the Christian doctrines of God, of creation, and redemption, as revealed in Scripture, it tones down and often virtually destroys these doctrines by combining them with a philosophy based on the principle of plenitude. That's a key word, and I'll explain it in a minute. To profit from this sad mistake into which we all tend to fall, it is imperative that the Christian principle be seen as the polar opposite of the principle of plenitude, and then he describes what he means, the principle of the great chain of being. To see this, it must first of all be observed that both of these principles are principles that claim to interpret the whole of reality. The Christian principle and the principle of plenitude alike include a view of God, of the world, and of man. Now, by the principle of plenitude, Van Til refers to the idea that God as super being necessarily unfolds his fullness in a great descending hierarchy or chain of being which stretches between himself and non-being. Van Til finds confirmation for his interpretation of medieval theology in one of its modern Roman Catholic defenders, a man by the name of Edion Gilson. Gilson speaks of God as total being. Interesting way of describing God. Shows his Platonic mindset. As such, he is, more especially, the true being, virum esse. And that means that everything else is only partial being, hardly deserves the name of being at all. And thus, all around that seems to us most obviously real, the world of extension and change around us, is banished at one stroke into the penumbra, which is a word that means fringe or border area, of mere appearance, relegated to the inferior status of quasi-unreality. Now, it's impossible to insist too much on the importance of this corollary, and its essential meaning, at least, must now be made clear. It is as the heir of this great struggle, then, between Neoplatonism and Christianity and Christian doctrine, and the systematizer of these contrary views, that we must look at Aquinas. Now, let me just give you again what Van Til is saying. There is super or supreme being up here. Super is the best word because it's being that goes beyond, above our knowledge. That's unfolded in a great chain of being that the medieval theologians would talk about. Everything is viewed as having a part in this great chain of being, and ultimately, you come down here to the concept of non-being again. So they look at all things as a part of this vast hierarchy of being. And as Van Til says, they have a view of God, the world, man, all of it fits into this great chain of being. And the religious, in Neoplatonism, the religious quest was a quest of ascending this chain of being through asceticism and then speculation and then contemplation. I'm trying to think of the word I want right here. But the last step here takes you beyond reason takes you into the realm of mystic trance, mysticism, that's the word I want. And when you've moved up the scale, you've freed yourself from an undue attachment to the world by asceticism. You've engaged in the work of theology and speculation and considered the high doctrines and mysterious doctrines of the Christian faith. Then you move to mysticism, and it's in mysticism that you finally attain the beatific vision, which is, of course, becoming one, at least knowledge, with super being and beholding the indescribably delicious God. All right? God here becomes just like the old candy bar. He's indescribable, but he's delicious. So he's indescribably delicious. Now, Christian, of course, doctrine of which Van Til is speaking, does not view all things as in a chain of being, but views all things as all being not as one, but as two, and views God as creator and man as creature, as separated by the creator-creature distinction. Now, what Aquinas was attempting to do, to make a long story very short, was to combine the principle of plenitude, the principle of the great chain of being, with Christianity, and to explain Christianity in terms of it. Now, of course, I've already told you that that's an impossible thing to try to do because the two principles are basically contradictory because of the absence of the creator-creature distinction and the fundamental character of the creator-creature distinction for Christianity. Now, any questions about this? I have at least a summary idea of what we're talking about here. The principle of plenitude is that the Supreme Being unfolds himself in a descending hierarchy of ideas, forms, and beings down to here. In Platonism, this whole thing is viewed in terms of emanation, and the whole process becomes eternal. That's the problem when you come to Christianity. The whole process is not eternal. It begins at a certain point, at the beginning of time, and in Christianity, the Logos and the Spirit are viewed as eternal, and the rest of this viewed as creaturely and finite. But you can see that in this kind of chain of being view, there's no real room for a distinction between the Logos and the Spirit and the rest of reality, because it all is fit into this great chain of being, which means there's only gradation kind of difference between angels and men and Logos and Spirit, which is in fact where the Arians were coming from in the early church. The Arians were the great grandchildren of Justin Martyr and tended to adopt the Greek view of hierarchy to look at the universe as related, something like this: Father, Son, Spirit, and then men, all right? And the Orthodox theologians, those who were trying to be Orthodox, who still had bought into this point of view, always drew the line between creature and creator right there. All the Arians did was say, no, the definition of God is that he's unbegotten. Since both Son and Spirit are begotten or proceed from the Father, they cannot be God. Only God the Father is God, and the Son and Spirit are lesser creatures. But it was the same basic... It was the same basic system. That's why it was so prone to heresy. It was the principle of hierarchy. Yes, Bob?
This would be the same, the word plenitude then would be the same as the word Pleroma.
It would be related to it, yeah, because you have God and the Gnosticism unfolding himself in all this... all these eons that kind of unfold his being and that descend and emanate from him. I don't know exactly why Van Til uses the principle of plenitude, except to indicate the idea of fullness, that the Supreme Being unfolds his fullness throughout the universe in this great descending chain of being. Yes?
And then the second question would be, is this being one of the explanations for a Christian Roman Catholic perfected view of things in the sense that man had a certain finiteness.
Finiteness in this scheme is gradation, and it's by definition sinful. I mean, if you're going to take this scheme seriously, this scheme has for its fundamental distinction, not an ethical distinction, but a distinction as to being. It's metaphysical. It's not ethical in character. It reduces all distinctions to metaphysical distinctions, to distinctions in terms of being. That means, if that's what exactly arrives at the Roman Catholic view, that when man, that flesh will naturally fall into disorder and sin unless it's kept in order by the supernatural gift that God gives. Once you lose the supernatural gift, flesh, human appetites, material reality, proceeds, you see, automatically, of necessity, to non-being, which is sin. I remember seeing the epistemological consequences of this. Any of you ever read the seventh book of the Chronicles of Narnia? Okay. Well, in the last book of the Chronicles of Narnia, I'll have to paraphrase it here. Lewis has the end of the world has come. Okay, the end of Narnia, and he is dealing with a whole situation that, in some ways, parallels some views of biblical prophecy held. And there's an occasion where certain people are coming before Aslan, the symbol of course God, and one of the children asked him, Aslan, won't you show them yourself? And Aslan replies, I'll show you what I can do and what I can't do. And some of these creatures, people, are viewed by Lewis as having descended so low in the scale of being that they can no longer know God. They've lost their knowledge of God or of Aslan. And even if Aslan tries to show himself, they can't see him. Because, you see, they have gone so low down the scale of being, and this is where C.S. Lewis's Platonic cast of mind begins to come out, that they can no longer have any knowledge of God. And he says it very plainly, if you understand the background of the book there. And again, you see, he's put knowledge into this descending hierarchy. You either ascend the hierarchy of knowledge, or if you don't, you go down it. So finally, you fall off the cliff into non-being. And if you fall off that cliff, it's only non-being, it's non-knowledge. And I think that's due to the fact that there was a Platonic cast of mind that many other things he wrote, of course, are very helpful. And I enjoy C.S. Lewis a great deal, but at that point, there was a Platonic kind of great chain of being view that sometimes snuck up and twisted and perverted certain perspectives of this. Okay? Now, it says there, then, of this great struggle between this system and this system, when, without realizing, of course, the contrast between the two systems, that we come to Aquinas. Now, his forerunner was Anselm. The medieval theologian Anselm is the forerunner of Aquinas' view of faith and reason and apologetics. In other words, he's the halfway point or house between Augustine and Aquinas. Any treatment of Anselm's apologetic significance must begin with an understanding of his view of faith and reason. He follows Augustine, and adopts his motto, Credo ut intelligam, which means, of course, I believe, in order to understand. Yet all the emphasis of Anselm was on the ability of reason without faith in the Bible to prove or defend the truths of the Christian faith. There appears to be no doctrine of the Christian faith which one cannot prove by means of reason. No doctrine, provided you are aware of it in some way, could fail to be proved by a right use of reason. Now, this summary of Anselm shows how the classical defense of the Christian faith by means of pure reason is beginning to take shape in this medieval theologian. Anselm believes that the Christian faith can be defended on the basis of pure reason and without reference to the authority of Scripture. Now, this tendency is given manifest exhibition in Anselm's construction of the so-called ontological argument for the existence of God. It's called the ontological argument because it insists that the greatest idea in our minds must also exist in being. Ontological being derived from the Greek participle onton, which is the participle of the to-be verb, being. Ontology is the study of the nature of being or reality. Ontological means having to do with being. The proof itself is quite short, covering less than 2 pages, and here it is. And so, Lord, is put in the form of a prayer, do thou, who dost give understanding to faith, give me, so far as thou knowest it to be profitable, to understand that thou art as we believe, and that thou art that which we believe. And indeed, we believe that thou art a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. That's the key sentence. Or is there no such nature, since the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God? Psalm 14:1. But at any rate, this very fool, when he hears of this being of which I speak, a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, understands what he hears, and what he understands is in his understanding, although he does not understand it to exist. He's saying, even the fool would say, well, God does exist. He's a being greater than which nothing else can exist. And therefore, he knows there is such an idea, even though he doesn't agree that there is such a thing. Okay? It's in his mind, whether he agrees it's in reality or not. For it is one thing for an object to be in the understanding, and another to understand that the object exists. When a painter first conceives of what he will afterward perform, he has it in his understanding. But he does not yet understand it to be, because he has not yet performed it. But after he has made the painting, he both has it in his understanding, and he understands that it exists, because he has made it. Hence, even the fool is convinced that something exists in the understanding, at least than which nothing greater can be conceived. For when he hears of this, he understands it. And whatever is understood exists in the understanding. And assuredly, that than which nothing greater can be conceived cannot exist in the understanding alone. Another key sentence. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater. Therefore, if that than which nothing greater can be conceived exists in the understanding alone, the very being than which nothing greater can be conceived is one than which a greater can be conceived. But obviously, this is impossible. Hence, there is no doubt that there exists a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, and it exists both in the understanding and in reality. And it assuredly exists so truly that it cannot be conceived not to exist. For it is possible to conceive of a being which cannot be conceived not to exist. And this is greater than one which can be conceived not to exist. Hence, if that than which nothing greater can be conceived can be conceived not to exist, it is not that than which nothing greater can be conceived. But this is an irreconcilable contradiction. And so is what's in our brains at this point. There is then so truly a being than which nothing greater can be conceived to exist that it cannot even be conceived not to exist. And this being thou art, O Lord our God. So truly, therefore, thou dost exist, O Lord my God, that thou canst not be conceived not to exist, and rightly. For if a mind could conceive of a being better than thee, the creature would rise above the creator, and this is most absurd. And indeed, whatever else there is except thee alone can be conceived not to exist. To thee alone, therefore, it belongs to exist more truly than all other beings, and hence in a higher degree than all others. For whatever else exists does not exist so truly, and hence in a less degree, it belongs to it to exist. Why then, as the fool said in his heart, there is no God, since it is so evident to a rational mind that thou dost exist in the highest degree of all? Why? Except that he is dull and a fool. Well, what shall we think of Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God? Well, first, let me state the obvious. It's obvious that it's not as clear and compelling as Anselm claimed it to be. Of course, it's not to be expected that atheists would think it compelling, nor would their refusal to accept it prove that it's not. But even theists and Christians have found it faulty or confusing. Gordon H. Clark notes that even at the time of Anselm, a monk named Gonillo undertook to refute Anselm's proof. Second, it seems clear that upon examination, Anselm's proof assumes an epistemology and philosophy, which is influenced by a form of Christianized Platonic philosophy. Note the footnote by Van Til here. Van Til says, indeed, the very idea that if we think something exists, that if we think something exists greater than which nothing else can exist, then it must exist, seems suspiciously like the idea of Platonism, that the human mind participates in the being of the ideal world and derives its ideas from thence. Van Til's comments on Gilson's assessment of this argument confirms this point. It is no wonder, then, says Gilson, that Anselm discovered the ontological proof of the existence of God. The whole point of this argument is to the effect that if one denies God, one denies being. The inconceivability of the non-existence of God could have no meaning at all save in a Christian outlook where God is identified with being, where consequently it becomes contradictory to suppose that we think of him and think of him as non-existent. So, I think there's reason to agree that there is assumed here a kind of form of Christianized Platonic philosophy. Although I have to admit that upon reading it, I think that at points he's trying to state the self-evident and necessary character of the existence of God to explain existence. And insofar as he probes in that direction, there may be some sort of anticipation of the idea of innate knowledge of God in the transcendental argument. But fundamentally, I think we have to say that the proof doesn't carry people because it assumes a certain kind of philosophy. All right? Now, with these introductory explanations in our mind, we may now proceed to deal with two important features of Aquinas' apologetics. First of all, faith and reason in Aquinas. Now, you've seen this in Anselm. He believes that reason can prove every doctrine of the Christian faith. He might admit that you have to have the Bible and faith in the Bible to know it in the first place. But once you know the doctrine, you can prove it from reason without faith. Now, Aquinas disagrees with that. Aquinas adopts the same distinction between faith and reason which we saw in Anselm. He disagrees with Anselm, however, on an important point. Aquinas does not believe that it is possible to prove all Christian truths or mysteries on the basis of reason alone. This disagreement was probably due to the fact that Aquinas was trained in the philosophy and logic of Aristotle. Thus, he was more strict about what it meant to rationally prove a doctrine. This disagreement with Anselm led Aquinas to distinguish between philosophy, which was the realm of reason and theology, the realm of faith, and, the realm of faith. Reason is sufficient to demonstrate the truths of philosophy. Only faith in the Bible can lead us to the mysterious truths of the Christian faith. All right? So there's a distinction now between the realm of faith and the realm of reason that Aquinas is going to work with through all his thinking. So you have faith, and you have reason, and reason is unable to penetrate completely or to absorb into itself all the faith. No, there's a distinction between faith and reason, and what the realm of one and the realm of the other. Yet Aquinas made a further distinction. Some truths fall within the sphere of both. Philosophy, the reason giving you philosophy, and theology. He says some truths fall within the realm of both. All right? Thus philosophy and theology overlap. Among the truths in this area of overlap is the truth of the existence of God. God's existence is the truth, therefore, of both faith and reason, of both theology and philosophy. This area of overlap is the area of natural theology, That's a key word that we're going to spend a lot of time or phrase talking about. This area right here, the area of overlap, is the area that's classically been known as natural theology. Natural because derived from reason, but theology because it concerns truths of the Christian faith. Now, this area of overlap is the area of natural theology, and then you need to supply the word which is able to prove the existence of God and other truths important to religion as well. And they would often include here truths like the immortality of the soul. Thus, reason, working in the area of natural theology, and then you have to supply some other words. I don't know what happened to me at this point, but reason, working in the area of natural theology, is able to prove the existence of God and other truths. He's able to prove the existence of God and other truths. In other words, the point is, without faith or the Scriptures. Now, this natural theology, which may be based on reason alone, forms a kind of introduction or preamble or rational prelude to the Christian faith. Now, the implications of this view of faith and reason for Christian apologetics are applicable, very important. Aquinas' treatment of reason clearly shows a great confidence in reason. It also assumes that faith and reason are independent from each other. It places believer and unbeliever in the same place with regard to the truth of the existence of God. The fall of man and the reality of sin appear to have had little or no effect on the reasons of men for Aquinas, because he has complete confidence that through reason alone, without faith, we can prove to unconverted men, and without even our own faith in the Scriptures, the existence of God and other truths. Any questions? Yes, Bob?
I'm trying to remember, you said before, and I'm not sure who you that something about proving the that of God instead of the what of God. Is this what Van Til
says? That that's fundamentally the position of Aquinas and culmination of medieval theology. In his syllabus on the subject, I'm trying to remember, he talks about natural theology and negative theology. And negative theology, I think, has to do with the full realm of reason. And that basically saying is you can say what God is not, but you can't say what he is. So you only know by way of negation. Well, the point is that the Scriptures also tell us certain things that God is. He is Father, He is Son, He is good, He's holy and just. And what Aquinas would be saying by that is that many of those truths would have to be await the Scriptures, but that you can have a knowledge of the existence of God that doesn't necessarily tell you what God is, it only tells you that God is. Van Til sometimes characterizes, I think it may even be in the Defense of the Faith, medieval theology that way. I'm trying to remember, I believe it's Van Til says that. I've gotten here in the notes, I think I had it in my older, more extensive notes. I summarized all of this and tried to make a little bit more coherence out of it. Okay, go.
You're probably going to get to this, but it's the problem with that type of reasoning that in order to understand that God exists, in a sense, it's kind of impossible to think of God existing without thinking of what God is.
Well, of course, the Bible teaches that we not only know that God is, but we know what God is. That we know not just some notion of the existence of God abstracted from his actual being, but we know God. Let's come to the five ways of Aquinas. The five ways of Aquinas refers to the five arguments which Thomas Aquinas brought in order to prove or demonstrate the existence of God. The term demonstrate is significant because Thomas is asserting, notice, that proofs, that is, proofs, provide more than suggestive or probable evidence for the existence of God. Clark notes, obviously, therefore, with his Aristotelian background, Thomas presents his proofs as formally valid demonstrations. Carnell writes similarly, let us be careful to point out that Thomas is referring to deductive demonstration, not probable induction, in his proof for God. We can demonstrate the existence of God from his effects. That's Summa Theologica 1Q2A2. So we're talking about here actual deductive demonstration. We're not talking about probability then for Aquinas. Inductive probability, in other words, you have a theory, you find 25 facts from some sort of scientific study to support the theory, and it seems that a high degree, the hypothesis seems to have a high degree of probability. That's not what we're talking about. Aquinas does not want inductive probability. He wants demonstration. By the way, that gets back to the whole issue of empiricism and the scientific method, which cannot claim ever to give you anything more than probability. And in fact, many modern scientists admit that. The best you can ever get is probability from induction, and since empiricism works by way of induction, that's what you have. Anyway, deductive demonstration is what Aquinas was after. This means that the proof must bear the same compulsion as a mathematical equation or a case of the syllogism. Now, the five ways presented. Now, in order to introduce the student to the Thomistic proofs for the existence of God, I'll borrow Clark's translation of the first proof from his Tales to Dewey. After I get done with this, you can see after the end of it, after page 58, I've got a couple of other sheets in here that will summarize the other proofs for you. They're there, aren't they? Page 58 and following, after Kelvin. Good, okay. Anyway, here's Aquinas' first proof, as translated by Clark in his Tales to Dewey. The first and more manifest way to prove the existence of God is the argument from motion. It is certain and evident to our senses, that's an important phrase, that in the world some things are in motion. Now, whatever is moved by another, for nothing can be moved except it is in potentiality to that towards which it is moved. Whereas, a thing moves inasmuch as it is an act. Note the distinction between act and potentiality. For motion is nothing else than the reduction of something from potentiality to actuality. But nothing can be reduced from potentiality to actuality except by something in a state of actuality. Thus, that which is actually hot, as fire makes wood which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, and thereby moves and changes it. Or, if you think of the billiard table, you have a ball in motion and a ball that's sitting still. The ball that's sitting still will begin to move only when something that's in motion reduces it from potentiality to actuality. It has the capability of being moved, but it doesn't move until something that's actually moving hits it. That's the idea. Now, it is not possible that the same thing should be at once in actuality and potentiality in the same respect, but only in different respects. For what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot, but is simultaneously potentially cold. It is therefore impossible that in the same respect, in the same way, a thing should be both mover and moved, i.e., that it should move itself. Therefore, whatever is moved must be moved by another. If that by which it is moved be itself moved, then this also must needs be moved by another, and that by another again. But this cannot go on to infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently, no other mover, seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are moved by the first mover, as the staff moves only because it is moved by the hand. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at the first mover, moved by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. The moved, mover, of whom you've heard so much about. Clark notes that all the proofs are essentially similar. It will be adequate, therefore, simply to provide the student with a couple summaries of the five proofs at the end of this section. Now, what's the five ways presented? Very interesting, huh? The unmoved mover. What do we say about the five ways? Well, let's discuss them. If one is to understand, first of all, as we talk about their character, the five ways and properly assess them, several things must be understood about them. The first thing that must be understood is that the five proofs are built upon the denial of any innate knowledge of God. Says Clark, Thomas faced two other contrasting views. One is that the existence of God is self-evident and neither needs nor is susceptible, capable of proof from prior first principles. Those who hold this view argue that God has implanted in all men an elemental knowledge of himself. The idea of God is innate. On this showing, any argument or so-called proof could be nothing more than a clarification of already present ideas. And such an effect was the nature of Augustine's, Anselm's, and Bonaventura's attempts. Now, in one sense, Thomas is willing to admit that God's existence is self-evident. It is self-evident in itself. It is self-evident to God. But it's not self-evident to us. God has not implanted ideas in the human mind, and all knowledge must be based, here's empiricism now, on sensory experience. All knowledge must be based on sensory experience. Now, the second thing that must be understood about Aquinas' five ways is that he claimed biblical support for his methodology. Says Clark, we can also be assured that the proof is possible by the words of the Apostle Paul, the invisible things of him are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. This verse could not be true, says Thomas, unless the cosmological argument were valid. That the demonstration proceeds from the things that are made is in accordance with Aristotle's theory of demonstration. There are two methods of demonstration. One is from cause to effect. The other is from effect to cause. From every effect, the existence of its proper cause can be demonstrated so long as its effects are better known to us, because since every effect depends on the cause, if the effect exists, the cause must pre-exist. All right. Third thing that must be understood is that these proofs assume Thomistic philosophy. In other words, they assume Aquinas' peculiar mix of Christianity and Aristotelian philosophy. Speaking of the first proof, Clark remarks, this quotation, however, is more realistically understood not as a complete demonstration, but as a summary of demonstration, of a demonstration. Obviously, its premises need to have been established elsewhere. Potentiality and actuality. The definition of motion. The necessity of a mover. The repudiation of infinite regress. You know what infinite regress is? It's a statement where he says you have to have a first mover. You can't just have an infinite series of movers. Okay? That's infinite regress, or the repudiation of it. All our conclusions from a long series of prior arguments and involve discussions not only on physics, but chiefly on epistemology. If there's a break anywhere in this long chain of reasoning, the culminating proof quoted above will depend upon a fallacy. Any discussion of Thomas' philosophy is criticism of the proof of God's existence, for this proof is the culmination of the philosophy. Well, that's the character of the five ways. Any questions before we come to their criticism? All right. Now, there's this philosophical foundation which opens Thomas' proofs up to criticism. He has committed himself to prove the existence of God within the bounds of his philosophy. But Thomistic philosophy is committed to a strict empiricism. Empiricism teaches that sense impressions are the only or primary source of knowledge. Carnell indicates, notice the footnote, that for Thomas, sense impressions are the only primary source of knowledge. Nihil est in intellectu nisi prius fuit in sensu. There are no inborn ideas, nor are there any notions within the natural range of experience infused in the mind by a divine influence. What those words apparently mean. Thus, all the objections which have been raised against empiricism are also criticisms of Aquinas' proofs for the existence of God. Now, without denying that there's something compelling about these truths, and I'm not denying that, by the way, it remains true that they are open to the devastating criticism by rigorous logic. Carnell spends 10 pages in criticizing these truths. R.B. Myers and K.J. Clark also believe that the Thomistic truths leveled at these truths are as follows. First, there's no way empirically to demonstrate that the unmoved mover or first cause, necessary being, perfect being, and great designer are identical with the Christian Trinity. You get to an unmoved mover, but why do you know that that's the God of the Bible? Why couldn't it be the God of the Quran? That's the problem, you see. Aquinas' conclusion to his first argument is really only a leap of faith when he says, therefore it is necessary to arrive at the first mover, moved by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. The fact is that not everyone does understand it to be the Christian God. Thus, this argument falls short from the standpoint of Christian apologetics, because Christian apologetics wants to prove the existence of the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Secondly, the argument from design, and that is one of the arguments, called the teleological argument, one of the other arguments it gives, the argument from the fact there seems to be design in the world, from the Greek word telos, goal. The argument from design does not take into account the evil in the world. If the design and wisdom in the world demonstrate a great designer, what do those aspects of the world which appear evil and foolish demonstrate? Carnell remarks, conscientiousness and empiricism indicates that life is a mixed affair, partly good and partly bad. Shall we then reason from this to an absolutely good God? It's difficult to see how this follows. When one beholds the history of humanity, the struggle of animals, the untold waste and destruction in nature, the ruthless slaughter of human values, and the death of the universe under the hand of the second law of thermodynamics, it's difficult empirically to affirm that the universe is as perfect as the defenders of Aristotle's arguments have it for the arguments to be significant. Is it not evident that when we reason after the pattern of the relationship between the artist and his work, the poorer the work, the less perfection we attribute to him? A chip on the statue or a flaw on the canvas makes the artist inferior. Is not God, then, less than all perfect? He's the God who created this world. And if God is responsible, you say, well, but you've got to deal with the fact of sin, yes. And where did you get the fact of sin? You just presupposed it and imported it from Christian revelation. But you never read the Christian revelation yet, because you haven't even proved that God exists. From the standpoint of empirical philosophy and theology, you see. Three, the very concept of cause cannot be proven empirically. An empirical epistemology rules out the existence of any non-empirical reality, because it says only what you can sense exists. You can only know what you sense. That's the epistemology. Well, if that's the epistemology, then you've got to be able to sense anything for it to be real, for it to exist. Empiricism demands something it can see or sense if it is to believe. The problem is that no one has ever actually seen or sensed the cause. Carnell says, Hume, David Hume he's referring to, carefully showed that what we think is a connection between cause and effect is but a fixation of the mind and does not represent a valid inference from sense perception. Cause and effect are but habits or conventions of the intellect which express invariably related impressions that have taken rise from one's viewing the concourse of flux or change. Causation implies no more than this, that like objects have always been placed in the relationships of contingency and succession. In other words, all we can see is that certain things always happen in the same order. And this removes the support of the argument. Now, Carnell isn't agreeing with Hume that there's no such thing as cause. I'm not sure that Hume is saying that. But what he's saying is that you've just said you've got to be able to see something to believe it. No one has ever seen cause. They've seen succession of events. They've seen repetition in the same succession, but they've not seen a cause. Again, What the empiricist wants to know is why the universe need have an efficient cause at all. If no reason need, now here's the key, if no reason need be given for God's uncaused state, why not shift that prerogative to the universe? Hume remarks, by supposing it to contain the principle of its order within itself, we really assert it to be God, and the sooner we arrive at the divine being, so much the better. When you go one step beyond the mundane system, he means the world, you only incite an inquisitive humor, an overly curious spirit, which it is impossible ever to satisfy. In other words, he's saying, why do we have to have a cause for the world at all? Well, you've got to have a cause for the world. Yes, we also assume. But Hume asks, why do you need to have a cause for the world at all? Well, we have to have a cause, you know. But he says, well, you have a cause for God. No, God just is. Well, he says, why can't we just say the world just is? Okay, Paul?
Couldn't it be categorized as an empirical observation that impersonal matter never produces personal matter?
Could that be categorized as it? Well, of course, the problem is, have you ever seen a soul? And have you ever seen, and how do you define a person? Yes. The fact that right. Sure. The fact that I'm speaking to you is a matter of empiricism. The fact that I'm a person and that it's a soul speaking to you is one of the great proofs that empiricism is inadequate, because you haven't seen my soul. You haven't seen my person. You've seen my body, and you've heard
my conclusion that you are a person
is based on something other than empiricism. All right, now, we'll may come back to that. That's an interesting thought. You see, throughout this gets hard to follow at some point, because we're talking about strict empiricism. We're not talking about what we actually think. We're not saying I don't want to argue against the fact that the common sense fact that you know that I'm a person, and part of the reason you know that is because I'm talking to you. I'm not arguing against that. I'm just saying, we're talking about now an empirical epistemology. And within an empirical epistemology, how do you know that? See, we have to keep that qualification in mind. We're not saying that empirical epistemology is correct. We're just asking the question, what does it allow us to know? Well, yeah, but is that an empirical observation? You've never seen it happen. But does that mean it doesn't happen?
But the point being, I think that not that that observation is wrong, but that you're going beyond your, if you're an empiricist strictly, then you're moving a step beyond that.
Yeah, we're not saying Hume is right. We're just saying he's right about what you can know within the boundaries of empirical epistemology.
That's what I was trying to have clarified. Is that indeed an empirical observation? Are you importing something when you say non-personal objects do not introduce personal?
I that's the reason I ask you, have you ever seen a soul? Because in order to even talk about persons and these kind of things, you have to assume the existence of the soul. And can you do that on the basis of empiricism?
The fact that you speak to me that you need to be ideal, while that in itself is an empirical observation, because it is something that is sensory.
Mm-hmm.
I hear But my conclusions about the source, what can the source of that hidden, my conclusion that there is an immaterial soul is not
empirical. Not empirical. Now, see, the point is you're getting at something that's one of the devastating criticisms of empiricism. Because sense perception means nothing if there's someone isn't someone there perceiving it. But you've never seen the person or the soul that's perceiving it. You haven't seen that. Therefore, it doesn't exist. That's the conclusion that empirical epistemology drives you to, which is why many empirical scientists have become atheist and naturalist, because they have never seen it. You say, well, think about this, because we come into another point that I think is crucial to understand. The cosmological argument. This is the argument from the cosmos. Or the world. The argument from the world. And that's really the one we read to you about the unmoved mover. That the world is in motion must have had someone to put it in motion. The cosmological argument for God's existence is the argument from the fact that the world must have a cause. Now, think about the argument. The world must have a cause. God must be that cause. That's the boil it all down. That's what it is. The cosmological argument is built upon the assumption of sufficient reason. Sufficient reason. In other words, the idea is that nothing can be uncaused or the cause of itself. You say the world must have a cause because, why do we say that? Because we have the assumption, the presupposition, that everything must have a cause. Nothing can be the cause of itself. Therefore, the world must have a cause. Right? That's the assumption. That's the presupposition of the argument. But the cosmological argument is also built on the denial of infinite regress. Says Mayers, as he continues, there must be a final cause, or the continuum of cause and effect would go on to infinity. You'd simply have an infinite circle of cause and effect working itself around until you got back to the beginning, which doesn't get you any place. All right? You can't have infinite regress. You can't have a cause that keeps going back forever, because you don't get any place with that. You might as well have no causes at all. Now think about it. The cosmological argument begins with the presupposition that everything must have a cause, but when it gets to God, it says he doesn't have a cause. Which is what? Two contradictory presuppositions. You start off by saying everything must have a cause, but you get to God and say he doesn't have a cause. You have the assumption of sufficient reason and the assumption of the denial of infinite regress. So you have an argument that's based on a contradiction. Everything must have a cause, and therefore you have infinite regress, or everything need not have a cause, and therefore you can't assume sufficient reason. And therefore, you can simply say, the world exists, and that's it. Kelly James, pardon me, I want to continue to quote Mayers here. There must be a final cause, or the continuum of cause and effect would go on to infinity. The denial of the possibility of an unending sequence of causes and an assumption smuggled into and not logically demonstrated by the argument. The cosmological argument thus ultimately begs the question by concluding that God is the first efficient cause, but also an uncaused member, the existence of which was absolutely denied at the beginning of the argument. This is certainly a greater logical inconsistency than accepting an infinite series of causes. Keller James Clark cites the response of the famous atheist Bertrand Russell to the cosmological argument. Why does the universe exist? Russell believes that it just does. Period. And that's the end of the reasoning process. As Russell says, I should say that the universe is just there, and that's all. Russell has chosen at a certain point to give up the principle of sufficient reason. The theist that is alleged also gives up the principle of sufficient reason when it suits him. The theist will answer the question, why does God exist, in a similar fashion. He just does. The application of the principle of sufficient reason must stop somewhere, but it's not clear where one is rationally compelled to stop by applying the principle. It's difficult to defend one's stopping point without appealing to one's belief or non-belief in God. Surely the theist will think it appropriate to stop only with God, yet the non-theist will stop at the universe. So the cosmological argument is built on this on two contradictory presuppositions, the assertion of sufficient reason and the denial of infinite regress. Yes, Bob?
Now, in a sense, I mean, just, you know, when we see these arguments, they are, in effect, compelling. And this argument that we just looked at, if we, they're compelling to us because we import into it the creature, the creator's distinction. So we say that God is the cause because he's the creator, whereas all creation
needs a cause because it's obviously dependent.
So we could use this argument in the sense of, as long as we are presupposing that distinction.
Right. We see it when we say that's right. And we and that's about what I'm about to get to, in fact. But the point, and that's Van Til's point, that the arguments are valid if they're built on the right presupposition. But what proves this is the creator creature distinction and the fact that the world around us, as we look at it, appears to us to be a dependent created thing. But once you say that the world is a dependent created thing, you presuppose what? There's someone upon whom it's dependent and who created it. All right, does the world strike us as dependent and created? Of course it strikes us that way. But you see, can you prove that? No, because it's kind of a first principle, it's a presupposition. Okay? Now, I want to come then to the appeal of all this. Because I don't want to leave it there with Bertrand Russell, the atheist, winning today. Their appeal. Well, this is a good place to take up the appeal of these arguments. For it's undoubtedly true that these arguments have manifested over the centuries a certain measure of logical appeal. The power and logic of the criticisms mentioned above do not remove or reduce the sense of many Christians that there is an element of truth in these arguments. And I remember a very small boy coming up with one of these arguments or what looks very similar to it and being fairly convinced by it. Anyway, if we would understand this phenomena, we must remember the perception of William Adams Brown, who was cited by Carnell. The professed purpose of the argument is to discover a cause adequate to account for the world we see. That's the whole point of the argument, from the cosmological argument anyway. But the implied assumption is that this cause must at the same time be such as to satisfy the religious longings and needs of man. But this result is possible only as we read into the evidence data which our religious intuitions or instincts supply. In other words, as we introduce into our procedure judgments of value of a kind which ordinary scientific reasoning excludes. Meares rejects both the validity of the cosmological argument and the idea of infinite regress, that there can be an infinite series of causes. Meares reasons that the cosmological argument does, however, present us with a choice. In other words, he doesn't think the cosmological argument is valid, but it does present us with a choice. Although the argument puts us on the horns of a dilemma, that either there is a first cause, or the universe is brute fact, it provides no rational reason demanded by the argument, notice the italics, by the argument for why I must grab the first cause horn other than prior theological assumption or gut feeling. But this gut feeling is important to the evangelical apologist. The intuitive attraction of the cosmological argument is the persuasive and pervading reality of general revelation. General revelation, however, is an a priori, or a presupposed or assumed fact concomitant with creation and not the derivative of an a posteriori argument from the fact of existence to the cause of such existence. Now, I think what he's saying here is really laid out as Clark enlarges on the appeal of the cosmological argument by noting how dissatisfying it is, even to atheists, to live in a universe without rhyme or reason. The world just exists, and that's it. Well, you may think that from one standpoint logically, but you've just created a universe that's very difficult to live in. He comments on it, and then cites Bertrand Russell again. Here's Kelly's Clark's comment. Of course, the non-theist must live with the untoward consequences of rejecting a sufficient reason, cause, or purpose for the existence of the universe. The non-theist must contend with the fact the world is at best inexplicable. And man's place in the universe is equally so. Russell, in one of his more candid or honest moments, recognizes man's plight in his purposeless cosmos. Such an outline, says Bertrand Russell, but even more purposeless, more void of meaning, is the world which science presents for our belief. Amid such a world, if anywhere, our ideals henceforward must find a home. That man is a product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. What an admission. What nonsense, in fact. How are you going to have a soul, and how are you going to have any purpose in a universe that has no purpose? It doesn't make any sense, you see. He can have that kind of universe, but he can't have reason, purpose, or meaning in it. Now, as Clark says, recognizing meaninglessness is, of course, not a reason for believing that the cosmological argument is sound. The non-theist is not logical for accepting these consequences. But he has to be able to live with the consequences. And, of course, it raises another question. Well, what are we doing with the concept of meaning and purpose and reason in a universe that has something like that? How do you explain? See, this is the transcendental argument. How do you explain the concept and the intuitive necessity for mankind of reason, meaning, and purpose without the assumption of the existence of God? Because you see, the opposite assumption gives you no explanation for the existence of such things. Kelly James Clark is correct. Empiricism provides no refutation of the despair which is the alternative to accepting the theistic solution to the cosmological argument. Yet the candid remarks of Bertrand Russell cited by Clark provide a penetrating insight into the reason why so many minds have found the cosmological argument to appeal to their minds. The fact is that the world viewed as the ultimate reality is not friendly to human values and ideals. Furthermore, there's a kind of immediate awareness in the human being that the world is itself an effect which must find its cause and explanation outside itself. Similarly, the other Thomistic truths do point to, and even assume without admitting it, the common human awareness that we in the world we live in are dependent, created, or contingent, designed, originated. But such perceptions are not distinguishable from the fact that we have an immediate awareness of our Creator. Hence, the appeal of these proofs is simply that they lay hold in many minds of the awareness of our and the world's dependent, created character. This is just a sale of it. These proofs can only succeed when they frankly admit that they presuppose the existence of an independent Creator. This means, however, they are not proofs in the Thomistic sense at all. They fail and must fail if they purport to begin with a neutral data of sense experience and a neutral empirical epistemology and from thence prove the existence of God. All right. Any questions? I've got to run in just a few minutes, but if you have questions, I have a few minutes to take them.
When you said back here that on page 41, the cosmological argument is also built on the denial of infinite regress, were you intending to say that in the quietness discussion?
Yes.
As far as I understood in the Summa Theologica, he posits that the universe is eternal, that you can't prove the universe. You must start with an eternal universe. And then after that, so he affirms the infinite regress, and then you can prove God. So if he says he doesn't think there's any rest, and more than the average would put up also, then I would think
about that. I can't respond to that. I don't believe that's true. The whole matter of infinite regress for the
creation by reason, but you could posit the existence of God.
You could posit. Well, I think to make the confusion may be that. In Platonic philosophy, you can have movement from one thing to another in some sense without it being a matter of time. It's true enough, Origen, for instance, believed that souls were eternal. And the reason they were eternal is because they were part of being, but they were also dependent and a result. They were also a result of emanation from God, so that there was movement. In some sense, souls were dependent upon or an emanation from the Supreme Being, and they weren't. And there's confusion. There's movement without a movement in time, if I can put it that way. So I'm not sure that. I mean, we just read the words of Aquinas, and his words were that you've got to have a cause, and it's got to be God. Now, the world could be eternal without and still be caused. Apparently, that's the point that Aquinas had made. Okay.
So the denial of infinite regress is as far as a cause, not as far as or a mover, that is not as far as a
mover. I have to think about that. I'm not sure. Bob?
I'm just wondering if Mike is just what you're saying, that Thomas is saying, like, there's this, like, eternal process going on of cause and effect, God's eternal, and it's I was just wondering if that's the moment. No, I don't know. I don't have an idea.
Well, it is possible within Platonic philosophy to have a concept of things happening outside of time, so that there is progression outside of time. There's some sort of structure of progression. It's a hard thing to visualize, I admit. The closest way I can get to it is that if you have in the Trinity the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, there's an eternal relationship. There's the word I want. Relationship. The relationship of the world, I think what he would be saying is that according to reason, of course, now his reason is informed by Aristotelian and therefore Greek philosophy. According to reason, you can prove a dependent relationship, some sort of relationship, and in order to show that there was a creation in time, you would probably have to have access to the truth. Yeah. Now, how does that affect our critique of the cosmological? I don't think it does affect it, that I can see. Because there's still, in one sense or the other, a denial of infinite regress and the assumption of sufficient reason. Both are there. So, you have contradiction within its boundaries. Yes, Paul?
I'm looking for the reference in there. What was this quoting?
He's got a book called Both And.
That's fairly recent.
The last 10 years. Last 70s or 80s. I hope I've got it someplace in the notes. Sometimes in editing these things, I haven't paid close attention. I've got it on my shelf. It's both and a balanced apologetic. He says a lot of things that are good in both and, but then I think he ends up trying to hit some sort of mean point between presuppositionalism and evidentialism. I think that fails. I think he fails when it comes to that. Yeah. You get a lot of criticism because of it. It's a good book, yeah. It's a little brief introduction, but it's good. Yeah. Yes, Bob?
One thing, when I was reading and praying, what he says is that he believes that Christians can, as long as they admit certain presuppositions, abide through the second place.
Oh, praying.
As long as we know that we have certain presuppositions and include the transcendental argument. But,
what do you say, put them all in the framework of the transcendental argument or something like that?
I don't know if he would put it that way. See, he would say that that situationally speaking, we don't always find ourselves in situations with people that are philosophically astute, So we might sit with somebody on the plane and we might just use a couple of these traditional arguments. We might not even need to get into the deeper transcendental argument because, sometimes it doesn't take that to convert somebody just because of the fact that they have the knowledge of God in them.
And because all facts do, the facts as they really are, all do presuppose the existence of God. The facts as such to include, there are distinctions made in other places. I don't know if it's Pratt, I think Pratt does it. I think Otero may do it. I'd have to check my memory. Between the logical starting point of argument and the situational starting point. I don't know exactly. I think that's maybe closer to Frame's terminology. But there's a distinction between what the logical or and the situational starting point of an argument may be. And they're trying to get at the point you're just making, I think. I've seen that a number of places.
What Frame had is that he said that he felt that in a sense we have to admit that any one of these one truths are not sufficient because at their very best they present us with an incomplete view of God. Even if for some reason we can convince somebody of an unmoved mover, it doesn't necessarily prove a Trinitarian God.
Yeah, the reason, for instance, is take up the leap of faith that Aquinas makes. You have an unmoved mover. It's God. The reason that works is that it strips away people's denial, and when they get to that point, it automatically locks in to their intuitive consciousness of the existence of God. It locks into that, and therefore the argument works, even though logically, within the boundaries of the arguments, there's no reason why this acknowledgement of an unmoved mover should be equated with the Christian God. It is equated because of the reality of natural revelation, and general revelation.
Theism
in general.
And after that, you can do the action of the attributes, and then after that, you get to the revelation through miracles, and then you get to the Trinity. So they're not trying to explain the Trinity or the
First, the adequacy of that procedure and whether that transition can be made is in question.
Well, I know I'm not saying that, I'm not talking about that, but I didn't think it was a fair critique to say that they fail because they don't prove the Christian God or the Trinity, so they're not intending to prove God at that point. That's why I criticized them. If they didn't reach step five, then they only step one. They're not trying to get step five quite yet.
I think I'm assuming that the transition can be made from within the boundaries of that. I agree with you that there is a in that kind of approach what Van Til calls the blockhouse methodology, so that you attempt to get the block of natural theology and build on it the block of special theology. That's true. That's Warfield, and that's probably the whole classical tradition. I think what I'm assuming here is that transition, blockhouse methodology, is really a kind of adequate way of describing it, because there's no way of making that transition except by the arbitrary. The arbitrary procedure is simply setting special theology on top of natural theology. And
you mentioned, are you going to cover that, a critique of that process of transitioning
Yeah, well, I'll present Warfield's view of that, and I'll also present a critique of any other attempt to. I'm not sure if I'll do exactly what you're talking about. I think so. You know what's exactly in your mind, but we're going to talk about Warfield and contrast and open up his view of special revelation, how you authenticate it, and then we are going to critique any other doctrine of the authentication of special revelation except self-authentication. And that's going to include, but in principle, Warfield and some of the others in there someplace.
I think another point that I was wanting to make as far as what Strain was saying, I know he's opposing that, but what he's saying is, let's just say that he presupposed the Christian worldview. And let's just say I sit down with somebody on a plane and I use the cosmological argument. He would say that we shouldn't think that as presuppositional. We should think that to be wrong, that is to be, that we're not bound to try to bring in all of the arguments within Christianity at that one point to be comprehensive. Because in many ways, situationally speaking, it may just be one particular truth of Christianity that gets at that person's conscience. That may be a moral argument, a design argument.
You can use any number of things to boost the bubble.
Right. And so he's just saying, I guess what he was trying to do is warn people of this against their critique of the evidentialists in the specific point that they would say, well, look, this argument doesn't prove the whole Trinitarian Christian theology. Because he's saying that, well, situationally speaking, we don't always have to do that. We might appeal to somebody's standards. That might be all it takes, because it takes an argument on every type of thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, and I think one thing that's true is that presuppositions have often concentrated all their attention on demolishing versions of these arguments that are inadequate, and they've left a lot of wrong impressions in people's minds, which is why so many presuppositionists had to write books saying, look, we're not against evidences and so forth. I'd like to read Frame's book, because I think sometimes in attempting to state how exactly we're in favor of evidence, men haven't done a very good job of stating how positively you can use evidence. So I'd like to read that book. Okay. Mike, I like those page numbers from Hodge. I was just looking down in my office. I think I know the page numbers, but I'd like to know. You can turn that off. Yes, Patrick?